If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Calling all History Extra podcast listeners. We want to hear from you. We're currently conducting some research about our podcast, so please enter our survey for your chance to win a £100 Waterstones gift card. It shouldn't take any longer than 10 minutes, and as a thank you for taking part, UK residents who complete the survey will be given the opportunity to enter our prize draw for the chance to win one of two £100 e-gift cards to spend at Waterstones. The survey will be available to complete until 11:59pm on Sunday the 4th of October 2020. You can find the link in our episode description. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today's podcast guest is the historical novelist Ken Follett, who joined us to talk about his latest book, The Evening and the Morning. Set in the 10th century at the end of the Dark Ages, the novel's a prequel to The Pillars of the Earth. BBC History Revealed's editor, Charlotte Hodgman, spoke to Ken to find out more.
So, Ken, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
Without giving away too many spoilers, kind of summarise, you know, what is this new book that's coming out?
Well, it's set around the year 1000. In fact, it begins in 997 and finishes in 1007, which is, an interesting period for particularly British history, but also Norman and Scandinavian history. This is the moment when actually there are three groups, powerful groups of people who have their sights set on ruling England. Of course, the Anglo-Saxons, who are there already, but a rather weak and unsophisticated society, particularly militarily weak. The Vikings, who for 200 years had treated England like a shop where you didn't have to pay. And finally, the Normans, who are sort of eyeing us across the channel and getting interested in England. So those three groups, and as we all know, everybody, even people who don't subscribe to BBC history know that halfway through the 11th century, the Normans won that contest, two-thirds of the way through. But nobody knows that at the time of this story. It's also, so that's the period. The other aspect of it, which I liked when I was just starting out on this book, was that it tells the early history of Kingsbridge, which is the fictional town where the cathedral is built in The Pillars of the Earth. And this is now the fourth book that I've written that's set wholly or partly in Kingsbridge. And the readers are beginning to have an interest in this place for its own sake, as it were. There's a website dedicated to Kingsbridge.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, and we've seen it through the building of the cathedral, then through the Black Death, and then through the 16th century religious controversies and the Spanish Armada and all that. And now we're going back to see what this place was like before it was a big important city. In fact, when it was just half a dozen houses by a river.
And it's interesting that you say that this is a very interesting period of history, but it's also kind of a time when the kind of the English the sort of identity of being English is slowly beginning to be formed. Is that something that you were kind of you wanted to kind of show in the book through some of the characters, that this kind of notion of what it is to be English was sort of being created at this time?
No, I didn't think it was yet time for that. Talking about the end of the 10th century, beginning of the 11th century, true, England is being ruled as a single country, theoretically, but this is a relatively new thing. It certainly hasn't settled down, and quite how people identified is not clear to me. I'm not sure that we have a real concept of England until we get to the 16th century. And then Shakespeare, of course, articulates it with his usual verve and brilliance. But I don't recall before that, I don't recall anything much about, we are English, England is our country, and all that. So I think at this time, people probably still identified more with their county or city or region or even just the hundred in which their village was located. It's a jolly interesting question, I think. You know, what would those Dark Ages Anglo-Saxons say now if you said to them, what group do you belong to? But I don't think there's yet any evidence that they say England.
Okay, yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, the Vikings, you know, quite early on in the book, I don't want to give too much away, but there's quite a scary Viking raid takes place. Did you base that, you know, the details of that on kind of things that you've read about, you know, actual Viking raids that have been recorded, or, you know, what sort of impact were the Vikings having at this period in which the book is written?
Well, their impact was tremendous. And even if you'd never met, even if you were lucky enough never to have met them, you would be conscious of them as a threatening presence. A few miles away, liable at any rate to show up at any moment and set fire and steal everything that wasn't nailed down, kill people and all that sort of thing. So the impact, I think, was huge of the Vikings, just as a menace and a threat. Of course, by now they had been raiding for 200 years, and quite a lot of them had settled, particularly along the east coast of England. So, and I presume since they had settled in England, they no longer raided England. What are our sources of information about a Viking raid? Well, we have most importantly the ships. And there is a wonderful museum in Oslo in Norway called the Viking Ship Museum, which has two full-size ships, mostly original, some restoration, and they are very impressive. And the sense, they're very beautiful and menacing. And for me, that was the first sort of thing I grabbed hold of in thinking about the Vikings, that they had these beautiful, very fast ships, which also looked terrifying. And then we know something about their weapons. The most usual weapon at this point for almost everybody involved in battle would be a spear. This is something I learned in the course of writing the book. I gave my soldiers swords and axes and hammers, and all the historians that I was who were helping me get these facts right said the spear was the standard weapon at this time. So the spear would have been a weapon and some of them would have had iron helmets, We're now getting to where I start to imagine it rather than research it, because, of course, there is no picture in existence of one of these Viking raids. We know what they stole. We know that they took young men and women, they kidnapped young men and women to sell as slaves, because the Vikings had three large slave markets in Northwest Europe, and the Vikings controlled them, and they were in Dublin, Bristol, and Rouen. So we know that they, from that, we know that they were slavers. As for the actual fighting, you know, that's something that the historical novelist has to make up, given the basic facts that he knows. For example, I think it goes almost without saying that these men who came specifically to steal and kill and burn were likely to be more practiced at the art of violence than the fishermen and bakers and so on who they robbed. You know, ordinary village people might well have been brave enough to fight back, but it's not. But they wouldn't have won. They would have been foolhardy, much better, I should think, to run. And most of the people in the first chapter, most of the people in the town, that's what they do. They run away. It's what I would have done.
I think I'd have been there too. That's kind of one of the frustrating things about this period of history is how little of the detail that we know, because as you said, the you know, Vikings would have settled by then, but I mean, we probably don't know, do we, whether how these kind of the next generations of these settlers were seen. Were they seen as foreigners still? Were they it's a kind of an interesting thought.
I don't get the impression that they integrated, the Vikings, at this point. Because they're talked about, aren't they? We talk about Danegeld, the tax they paid, and the part of the country they occupied is sometimes called the Dane Law. So it seems to have been clearly identified in people's minds as the Viking territory. It's not as if they, you know, settled down here and there and blended into the population. It doesn't look as if that happened.
No. You mentioned briefly earlier about that you sort of bring in France and the Normans sort of beginning to come into the story. One of your main characters, Ragnar, she's a Norman noblewoman who comes to England. She marries an English alderman. Were marriages and unions between, you know, different countries or people from different countries common at this time? Are you basing this on anything that you've read?
Yes, I think they were common amongst the nobility. And I was confident in the story of Ragnar because at almost the same time, a young Norman woman called Emma of Normandy came to England and married the king, married Ethelred the Unred. She was, I think, 18 when she married him, and she appears in the book. So clearly, we see from that it wasn't, it doesn't seem to have been unusual for a marriage across the Channel to take place. Emma was a very interesting woman. She married Ethelred, and when he died, she married the next king of England, who was Canute. And then one of her children was Edward the Confessor, who was the next king of England. So there was a Norman woman who was absolutely at the heart of English politics for a very long period of time, and I would guess was extremely powerful. I mean, it's not very likely that somebody who lived that life was a shrinking violet. I imagine that I certainly imagine her as being a woman of power and influence in the English court. So she is an example of how despite the rhetoric of the time, which is all about women being inferior and over-emotional and feeble and all that, despite all that sort of thing, even in the Dark Ages, women could become very powerful people.
And did you get a sense that that was acceptable for a woman to be in a position of power?
Yes, I think, I suspect, it has always been acceptable, because we are constantly reading about princesses and countesses, abbesses, you know, a nun who was ruler of a convent might be extremely rich and employ many people and have tremendous influence in the area which she owned, or the convent owned, but she certainly had the rights of ownership. So, and it was commonplace, I think. When a lord, when a nobleman went to war, somebody had to mind the shop, and most of the time that would have been his wife. That would be who he trusted. That would be who knew the territory, who knew who the reliable people were and who the dishonest people were and all that sort of thing. So it seems to me that women have always played that kind of role, even though it wasn't always acknowledged.
And as you said, this is, you know, the end of this, the time period of this book is about sort of 60 so years before the Norman conquest. But it's interesting that Ragnar kind of, she struggles, doesn't she, to kind of, to adjust to life in England. What have you, did you kind of notice that what sort of the key differences between, you know, life as a Norman lady and you know, life in England at that time? Was there anything that kind of struck you?
Well, there's some controversy about this, because amongst historians of this period, there are really two factions. There are some who try to argue that the Dark Ages weren't as dark as people say, and that Anglo-Saxon society was sophisticated and highly developed. I think that's a hard argument to make. They talk about the great Anglo-Saxon culture, but when you get down to details, what did Anglo-Saxon culture produce? Well, embroidery, okay. Embroidery at the time was a great and important art. And in fact, there was an exhibition at the Victoria and Albert Museum a few years ago that I went to see of English embroidery that had travelled all over the world. And these ancient pieces, mostly priestly vestments that had been embroidered with scenes of saints' lives and so on, Bible stories, had been sold or given to bishops and archbishops all over Europe. So okay, they were great embroiderers. That isn't quite a great culture. And it's certainly clear that the enforcement of the law was extremely weak in Anglo-Saxon society. And I find that more important than embroidery. There's an argument that goes on. Anyway, my take on it is that Norman society was more sophisticated than Anglo-Saxon society. I gave you that whole preamble because I don't want to pretend that this is the only view. There is an alternative view, but I think, and I would cite the fact that the Normans at this period, around about the year 1000, were already building elaborate castles and much bigger churches. In England at this period, there were no castles at all. We didn't have any castles till the Normans came. And the churches were very small. If you look at Anglo-Saxon churches in England today, those few that remain entire, they're tiny and dark and very poor building technique, very, very thick walls and tiny little windows, really very unsophisticated. The other thing that struck me, the difference that struck me, is that by this point, slavery had died out in Normandy, pretty much. There might have been a few slaves left, but it was very uncommon by this time, if not completely stamped out. And in England, it was commonplace. And if we're to believe the Doomsday Book, 10% of the English population were slaves. That's a big percentage. And it's a proper slave society. And the Normans were past that stage, probably. This is something that historians speculate about, but it seems plausible to me. The church was against slavery, not on human rights grounds, but because slaves are always used for prostitution. And the church was certainly against that. There's always been a connection, still is, tragically, between slavery and prostitution. And the church disapproved of that. Now, the church had a stronger hold over society in Normandy than it did in England. In England at this time, marriage was not a church service. Marriage was a civil ceremony in which two people made promises to one another in front of witnesses. And they might well ask a priest to bless the marriage, but they didn't need a priest, and the marriage was not a holy right. It was purely a civil thing. So the rules were not as strong. Bigamy was not forbidden by any means. Now, of course, Norman noblemen had mistresses, often living in the house, but it was unofficial. It wasn't recognised, whereas it seems that in England, the presence of more than one wife in a man's life was not unusual and was not regarded as a sin.
This is the earliest time period that you've covered in any of your books to date. What sort of difference or impact did that have on the way you went about researching it? Obviously, the sources, I'd imagine, were a big kind of a hindrance, I guess, the lack of.
Definitely. Definitely. People say to me, well, that's all right because you can make things up. But I actually prefer to have the facts because, history inspires me. That's what this is all about for me. And when I do the research and I find out interesting things about Anglo-Saxon society, it gives me the idea for scenes, dramatic scenes in the story. So, there is one rich source of information about society at this period, and that, of course, is the Bayeux Tapestry. It tells the story. It's a strip cartoon. It's coloured wool embroidered on linen panels. It's about 60 yards long. And it tells the story of the Norman conquest, but as it were accidentally, it also reveals an awful lot of wonderful detail about everyday life. Things like one of the panels shows people having dinner. So we see their tableware and we see the cooks cooking it alongside, and we see what they're sitting on and what they're drinking from. All that kind of thing is absolutely priceless for a period from which there are not many pictures and there's not much written information either about everyday life. There's a marvellous panel in which people are boarding a ship. There were no jetties at this period. So how did people get on board? Well, they hitched up their tunics and waded through the water until they got to the ship, and then they climbed aboard. And there's a marvellous picture of them doing this, including a lovely human touch. One of these people is carrying his dog, which I thought was lovely because, you know, dogs can swim. You don't need to carry the darn dog. He'll follow you. This must have been a very precious dog or something. Anyway, it was a wonderful touch. And the Bayeux Tapestry, there are two. The original is in Bayeux, of course, in Normandy, but there's a copy in the Reading Museum. For some reason, a bunch of 30 or 40 women in the Victorian era got together and decided to make a copy of the Bayeux Tapestry. And they embroidered all of these. I think there are 74 panels, something like that. But anyway, all of these, they just copied them pretty meticulously. I've seen both of these, and I didn't notice any differences between them. What was in those women's minds, I can't imagine. But they did us all a great service, because it does mean that you can look at the Bayeux Tapestry without actually having to cross the channel.
It's must have been a pretty daunting task to start stitching that.
Absolutely.
And one thing that probably a lot of your readers will be wanting to know is why you decided to write a prequel to Pillars of the Earth rather than carry on the Kingsbridge story beyond the last book.
Well, I think it's what I mentioned earlier, the attraction of thinking about what Kingsbridge was before it was a big town, and the story of how it became a big town. Because by the end of The Evening and the Morning, it is a town. It doesn't have a cathedral yet, but it's a thriving, prosperous place with a good deal of culture, as opposed to the hamlet that it is at the beginning of the story. And how that comes about is the kind of thing that interests me and gives me drama for the story. You know, when there's progress, of course, there are always people who don't want progress. You've got a situation in which some people say we must change, we must advance, and other people saying let's keep everything the way it's always been. We like things the way they've always been. Let's not change anything. And that's a jolly good social conflict for creating drama in this kind of story.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Slavery is always absolutely horrible. It's never an amiable, friendly sort of thing. Most books about this period don't emphasise the slavery, but if it was 10% of the population, it would have been right in your face.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it. So your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
There are some quite sort of big characters in this period. It's kind of written around during the reign of Ethelred the Unready. Some of your other books do kind of feature well-known sort of actual historical characters. Have you done the same with this book? And if not, why is that? Is that because the characters aren't there for this period, or you just chose to kind of make your own?
It's true that we don't know the identities of as many characters in this period as we do in later periods. Of course, in at this time, the king was a kind of judge of last resort, a quarrel that couldn't be resolved in any other way might be taken to the king. The king's ability to enforce his decisions is another story, because he was actually in some ways very weak. But so anyway, the king is in the story, but he doesn't show up in the evening and the morning until at least halfway through. And that's because he was, although he moved around a lot from city to city and from region to region, that it was, you know, with no phone and no postal service, it was quite difficult to get in touch with him. You would have to send a messenger to the last place he was known to have visited. And obviously a messenger along the way would be constantly saying to people, have you heard where the king might be at the moment? But it would be a very hazardous business trying to find the king to get a message to him, and trying to find him when he was holding court, and so that you could bring your grievance to him, would be even more difficult. So he's kind of an absent figure. He's in the story, and so is Emma of Normandy. And there are two archbishops of Canterbury who appear in the story, because, and you know, there were the two centres of wealth and power in England. Canterbury, number one cathedral, and the king, who is the most important non-religious figure of power. But there really wasn't, you know, there really weren't other interesting people. The other real person that I've mentioned in the story is Wulfbald. He doesn't actually appear. He doesn't come on stage, but people talk about him because famous legal case from this period, and it's the only Anglo-Saxon legal case, I think, about which we have it very much detail. Wulfbald, when his father died, he seized his stepmother's land. And in the Anglo-Saxon period, something that was lost when the Normans came, in the Anglo-Saxon period, women could own property. They had their own property. And this was illegal for him to take his stepmother's land. And she complained to the king, and the king, this was Ethelred, king ruled in her favour, and Wulfbald ignored him. And so the king fined Wulfbald. Wulfbald didn't pay the fine. And then the king ruled that Wulfbald's person and all his possessions were now the property of the king. Wulfbald ignored that. And eventually Wulfbald died without ever giving in. And after he was dead, his wife carried on behaving in the same way. So it's clear from that story to me, crystal clear, that a nobleman who was determined to defy the king could get away with it. Probably wasn't always the smartest thing to do, and most noblemen undoubtedly tried to get on well with the king so that they could get things from him, get more land and all that sort of thing. But somebody who took the opposite view could just defy the king, and it was very difficult for the king to do anything about it. There was no civil service, there was no standing army, and there was no police force. So the king, all the king could do would be to gather an army and go and do, what was it called? Harrying. Go and harry the neighbourhood. That was just a matter of setting fire to things and stealing things, making everybody's lives miserable and then going away again. It didn't actually, wasn't a very good way of enforcing the law. So anyway, that's Wulfbald. But other than that, there really aren't individuals who need to be in the story, real life individuals.
What about events? Did you decide to keep, because this period sees, of course, the St. Bryce's Day massacre in 1002. Is that something you chose to kind of keep? Was that relevant to the story? Did you keep that in the book?
No, that's not in the book, and the reason is that it's a bit muddied. The massacre was ordered, certainly, But it doesn't seem to have been carried out very widely. If I remember rightly, there were Vikings were killed in, was it Oxford? I think it might have been Oxford. Vikings were killed, but there's very little detail and very little evidence of you know, seriously large numbers of people being slaughtered. It offended the Vikings, apparently. That's very credible, because even if, you know, even if only a couple of hundred people were slaughtered, then that would offend them. But he ordered that all the Vikings in England should be slaughtered, and that would have been thousands and thousands of people, and that clearly didn't happen. So it's a story and it's not a story. And so I left that out. I kept in all the fighting around Exeter, because Exeter was a prize. It was a rich city. It was a river port, still is, obviously. I had a cathedral already then. Traders, wealthy priests, and there was a lot to steal, but it was quite well defended. And the Vikings made several attempts to take the city of Exeter. And for a long time, they didn't succeed. And then eventually they did. I think it was in about, if I remember rightly, it was about 1003 that finally the Vikings took the city of Exeter. And so there's a lot in the book about fighting around Exeter, because that's relevant. You know, Kingsbridge is vaguely somewhere in the southwest, roughly where Marlborough is today. And so people from my story would have had to go and fight in the battles in and around Exeter. And so we have some of that in it because it's directly relevant. But, you know, then I wonder, of course, it's in the massacres in the history books, but did people living 200 miles away even know?
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Yeah, like you're saying, like communication and you know, people tended to stay in their own communities. How, you know, how far did this sort of information travel? It's one of the things we don't really know, isn't it?
Well, I think we have to assume that news got around extremely slowly. It probably got garbled in the transmission even more than it does today on the internet and the tabloids. But the slowness, you see, is and in bad weather, you know, a trip that you'd now do in a car in half a day might take a week or two.
It's interesting that this period of history seems to have had a bit of a resurgence of popularity of late. I'm thinking, you know, things like, you know, the Last Kingdom on TV and things like that. People seem to be very kind of focusing on this at the moment. Why do you think it is? Why do you think we are so keen to learn about this period and you know, the Vikings and all this sort of thing?
There's a fascination, I think, about thinking about people who are basically like us, basically concerned with love and marriage, raising children, making money, going to war, people who really haven't changed in 1,000 years, people like us actually living in horrendously different circumstances. And you think to yourself, how would I have managed, you know, with, you know, every year subsistence farmers, I mean, it's still true in the world today. There aren't that many subsistence farmers left, thank God. But subsistence farmers, if there's a bad harvest, some of them die. That's how it works. Subsistence means subsistence. If there's not enough food, somebody starves. And, you know, it'll be the weaker in the bad years. It will be the weaker ones, the small children and the old people who go. But nevertheless, a bad harvest meant death for some of them. And that sort of living a life that brutal was also very violent. There was much more crime in these times than there is today. People think there's a lot of crime today. It's you know, Lincoln, 1 year, court records for 1 year in Lincoln, actually it's the year 1200, I think, show that the courts in Lincoln dealt with 100 homicides. Now, Lincoln was a city of 5,000 people. think of that many homicides. In fact, it's a huge level of criminality. And, you know, that, you know, people read something in the newspapers today and they're frightened to go to the shops. In those days, it must have been absolutely terrifying. So I think there's a sort of horrid fascination. I think part of the pleasure is making you feel how lucky you are to be sitting in your centrally heated house wearing your cashmere sweater to keep you warm and, you know, drinking a lovely glass of wine.
Did you find it hard to get yourself almost into the mindset of somebody who might have lived at that time? Because obviously, like as we said earlier, your later books cover, you know, perhaps we have more in common perhaps with people who lived obviously closer to where we are today. Did you find it harder to get yourself into that kind of early medieval mindset?
Well, perhaps a little bit, but you know, that is what this job is all about, is imagining yourself. The writer imagines himself in the heart of somebody who is not like him, somebody in a different historical period, somebody who lives in a different country, speaks a different language, might be a man writing about a female character or vice versa. It's what we do, and it's what this is all about. And it's, you know, once you get started on this, well, for me, I just always was like that. You know, when I was 9 years old, I was always a cowboy or a pirate or the captain of a spaceship. I lived in my imagination as a child, and when I grew up, I found a job that allowed me to continue living in my imagination. So that is sort of what we do. And, you know, somebody, if you can't do it with conviction, then you can't be a novelist. It's very basic. Conviction is, of course, the answer. I mean, the reader doesn't necessarily buy everything that you tell her or him, and you've got to be, you know, you've got to put things in the story which persuade the reader that you know what you're talking about.
Now, you've got a lot of followers out there who are very excited that you've done this prequel. It's 30 years, isn't it, after Pillars of the Earth, I think it is, was first published.
That's right, 1989.
Yeah. I've got a few questions just from people on social media when we let people know that we were talking to you today. So Jessica Roberts wanted to know, do you think humanity and humans are fundamentally the same regardless of the era they lived in? And if so, how do you relate to people in the past?
I think, yes, I think we are the same, certainly as far back as 1,000 years ago and probably farther. I mean, if you went back 12,000 years to the time of the hunter-gatherers, you might have second thoughts, but human beings don't change much in 1,000 years. My belief is that their fundamental concerns must have been the same as ours. Love and marriage and family and work and money and war and conflict. These things must have been the things closest to their hearts as they're closest to our hearts. And those are the things that we write about. There are a couple of people sometimes say, in those days, life was cheap. And if people had 7 children and 3 of them died, it wasn't such a big deal. I don't believe that. I don't believe that for a minute. I don't believe people ever found the death of children something easy to cope with. That makes no sense to me. There is a good argument to say that people could be crueler in those days. And if you think about the way particularly in the Middle Ages, the way people were executed, you know, burning to death, various other horrendous punishments. And I was very struck when I was writing A Column of Fire, which is set in the 16th century, that the theatre was just being invented. And the rival attractions were things like bear baiting, bullfighting. Apparently, Queen Elizabeth I loved to go to the bear baiting. And this is, you know, we think of Queen Elizabeth I as an extremely cultivated, intelligent and sensitive woman who cleverly ruled England for a long period of time. And yet she went to this awful, brutal sport, which involved torturing animals. But I think that in that way, people in the past may have been different from us. 'Cause most people today don't want to go to sports and shows that involve people being animals and people being hurt. Most of us shudder and turn away from that. So that may be one way in which we're different. But I think in the basics, I believe we're the same.
Laura would like to know something that you found fascinating or surprising that you found out whilst researching this particular book.
Well, I became aware while I was researching The Evening and the Morning of the extent to which England was a slave society. Something like 10% of the population were slaves. It's something that's played down by the historians. And some of my conversations with historians about this, they would say things like, well, it wasn't that bad. And I just don't believe that, okay? I mean, it's only my opinion, but I believe slavery is always horrible. One of the historians said to me, there's a scene in which somebody kills a slave that he owns, and he hasn't committed a crime because it's a slave. And a historian said to me, you know, it was against the law to kill a slave. And I said, well, let me read this law. And what the law actually says is that a man shall not kill a slave in anger, which means that if you do it soberly and rationally, it's okay. And if you do kill a slave in anger, the punishment prescribed was a joke. It was fasting, you know, when fasting means no meat. It doesn't mean not eating, you know. So it was a very narrowly specified crime, which you could easily wriggle out of by saying I wasn't very angry, actually. And the punishment was a joke. So the truth of the matter is you could kill a slave if you own. And that, of course, it's what it means to own a person. You own a person and you can kill him or her, do anything you like. There is a character in the story. There's a scene in the book where a character says owning slaves is very bad for people. It brings out the worst in them. And that, I think, I mean, that's my idea. That's not a Dark Ages idea. I just thought a sensitive person, I think it's a monk who says that, a person of sensitivity and moral awareness would have noticed something like that, even in the Dark Ages. And so, of course, there would have been decent slave owners and awful slave owners. But the fact of the matter was slavery is always absolutely horrible. It's never an amiable, friendly sort of thing. And I sort of, writing The Evening and the Morning, I sort of had to confront that. Most books about this period don't emphasise the slavery, but if it was 10% of the population, it would have been right in your face.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a huge amount of people.
Yeah.
And finally, just with one more, Zach Courtier wanted to know, are you planning to write any more Kingsbridge novels after this one? Well, chaining you to the desk already.
I'm not planning to, but there's a saying, never say never. And I'm certainly not saying never. Really, as far as I'm concerned, it'll be Well, that moment when I'm finishing one book and vaguely thinking about what I might do next, if I'm struck by an idea that I think is absolutely wonderful, and it's a Kingsbridge story, then I'll do it. And if I'm struck by something else, then I'll do that. So so I'm sorry that I can't give give Zach a more definite answer than that.
That was Ken Follett. The Evening and the Morning is out now, published by Macmillan. You can also read a Q&A with Ken in the November issue of BBC History Revealed magazine. That's on sale from the 1st of October and also includes an essential guide to the Vikings, as well as articles on the Mayflower, the slums of New York, and the UN. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in on Wednesday when John Wyatt Greenlee will be explaining why medieval people paid their rent in eels.
A collision between a Chinese jet and an American spy plane.
He came and rammed into our left wing.
With relations increasingly strained, what are the chances of things spinning out of control?
The Western world was asleep.
I'm Gordon Carrera. I'll be exploring the friction in this most important of relationships and asking, has the West taken its eye off the ball?
You cannot ignore China.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Shadow War, China and the West. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.